Good evening, and welcome to The Forum. Tonight on The Forum, we'll hear from author and analyst John Brewer as he speaks about a range of topics when he spoke at the Unitarian Fellowship of Lawrence back on January 11th. Here he is.
When I did a short talk on Father's Day last year, I mentioned the psychologist James Hillman as an adopted father. When Susanna Emilio heard this talk, she decided to give me one of Hillman's books, which is called The Soul's Code. When I read the chapter on invisibles in The Soul's Code, I thought this would be a perfect topic for a UFL program. So I emailed Ellen, and she gave me the green light. Hillman's idea in this book is called the Acorn Theory. He thinks that in addition to genetics and environment, there is a third formative force in determining who we become. Specifically, this force shapes our character. What does the word character mean to you? For me, it could mean any of the usual things. Moral decency. Trustworthiness, credibility. Oddness, as in, he's a real character. But in this book, character is returned to a stronger profile. Character is destiny. Ethos andropoi daimon. I phoned Stan Lombardo, who was my wife's billiard playing buddy, to learn how to pronounce this Greek. It's a fragment from Heraclitus, 6th century BC. It's only a fragment. We don't know what came before or after. We don't know what he was talking about. Everybody has their own idea about what this means. Stan said that the word daimon, which is the third word up there, it can be translated in a lot of ways, but divine spirit is probably the most common one. Ethos andropoi daimon. Character of man or humanity is the daimon, the divine spirit. When I first heard of this fragment, I understood it to mean that your character determines your destiny. And that was initially James Hillman's take as well. Here is my first reading from his book. What about ethos, the first term in Heraclitus's fragment? To our ears, it sounds like ethics. This loads ethos, a Greek word which is really unencumbered by piousness, with all the moralism of Hebrew, Roman, Christian religiosity. If we try to strip away the ethics from ethos, we find it carries more the meaning of habit. Heraclitus might have been saying that ethos is habitual behavior. Is Heraclitus then the first behaviorist? Is he saying, alter your habits and you alter your character and thus your fate? Never mind the underlying reasons, change your habits and your fate changes. I feel, and this is Hillman speaking, I feel Heraclitus is implying much more. This behaviorism sounds too willful, too Protestant, too American, and altogether too humanistic. Though Heraclitus connects character, ethos, and human ethics directly with the daimon, ethos andropoi daimon, it is the daimon's fate that becomes our concern. The egocentric focus of humanism makes us believe that the daimon, the divine spirit, having chosen us to inhabit, concerns itself with our fate. But what about its fate? Maybe the human task is to bring our behavior into line with its intentions, to do right by it for its sake. What you do in life affects your heart, alters your soul, and concerns the daimon, the divine spirit. We make soul with our behavior, for soul doesn't come already made in heaven. It is only imaged there, an unfulfilled project trying to grow down. The Acorn Theory states that each of us is singled out. The very fact of each-ness presumes a unique acorn that characterizes each person. Each has a character. In rare instances, the acorn shouts loud and clear at an early age. Musicians often hear the call first. At six, Pablo Casals already knew piano and organ music. Marian Anderson gave her first paid performance at 8 years old. She earned 50 cents. Mozart, of course, and Mendelssohn, too. Verdi's father, to stop his son's pleading, acquired a spinet for Giuseppe. At seven, Tchaikovsky was pleading already at age four. Excuse me, Giuseppe was seven, Tchaikovsky was four. The book is full of vignettes of famous and infamous persons. For the rest of us, it even has a chapter on mediocrity. Anyway, whatever we call it, acorn, diamond, calling, it's invisible. Invisible. So is it really there? Or is it just a charming notion? Here's the second reading. Since the acorn can't even be seen under a microscope, we postulate its invisible reality. To learn more about it, we need first to study the nature of invisibility. Invisibility perplexes American common sense and American psychology. They hold as a major governing principle that whatever exists, exists in some quantity and therefore can be measured. If an image in the heart that calls you to your fate exists, and may be strong and long-lasting, does it have measurable dimensions? A passion to cage the invisible by visible methods continues to motivate the science of psychology. Even though that science has given up the search for the soul in various body parts and systems, when the searchers failed to find the soul in the places where they were looking, psychology gave up also the very idea of soul. Great philosophical questions turn on the relations of visible and invisible. Our religious beliefs separate heaven and earth, this life and the afterlife, and our philosophical thinking cuts mind and matter, all of which forces a chasm between the visible and the invisible. How to bridge the chasm? What means are there for transporting the unseen into the seen? We have here the categories and the chasms. We can all agree that carrots are visible and real. Gravity is invisible and seems to be real for all practical purposes. Santa Claus is not real, but if he were, he and his reindeer would be visible and audible. Soul. Let's just say it's invisible. For some it is real, for others it is woo-woo. So how do we connect the visible and the invisible? Are there bridges that can move something from the woo-woo to the real? Let's look at some examples of bridges in recent history about which we should probably all agree. Take microorganisms as an example. They used to be invisible because we could not see them. Some people may have believed in them, so they could be placed in the woo-woo category. Sometime in the 17th century, Leeuwenhoek moved microorganisms into the real. With the help of the microscope, he also moved them into the visible. If only it were that easy for everything. The atom was a harder task. Leucippus, I think that's the way you say his name, in the 5th century BC, had the intuition that everything was made of tiny components, atoms, meaning uncuttable, couldn't make them any smaller than they were. They were too small to see, This idea was resisted by many, such as the positivists of the Vienna Circle, right up to the turn of the 20th century. Thanks to Boltzmann and Einstein and lots of others, the atom crossed the chasm from woo-woo to real. Still, its structure was debated later on. First, it became its own little solar system. Later, it became a cloud of probabilities. It really never has become visible. But people believe that they're there. Now let's consider an even trickier case. Cosmology. It's actually a time chart of the universe from the Big Bang, starting on the left, through inflation and all these different chapters. Cosmology was considered to be a joke and strictly woo-woo for a long time. Got to find my place here. The idea was in the woo-woo category right up until 1965. The idea that the universe had a beginning was lampooned as the Big Bang Theory. It was a term of derision at the time. Even so, physicist Jim Peebles at Princeton predicted the temperature of the radiation that would be left over from the Big Bang if there was one. That machine over there on the left side, that's a Bell telephone antenna. It was one of the old-fashioned ones. In 1965, two engineers from Bell Labs stumbled onto it, the cosmic microwave background radiation. Cosmology is now a respectable science. We can't see it, but we believe it happened. On the other hand, there are things that were once thought to be real, that were proven to be bogus, like phlogiston, and the ether as a medium through which light traveled. I don't have the stories on those. You can ask me at coffee hour if you want to hear more about them. In these cases, there was a bridge, but it was a bridge to nowhere, because nobody even considers these things even to be woo-woo anymore. Here is what James Hillman writes about bridges between visible and invisible. There are three traditional bridges: mathematics, music, and myths. The equations of math, the notations on a musical score, the personifications of myth cross the limbo land between two worlds. They offer a seductive front that seems to present the unknown other side, a seduction that leads to the delusional conviction that math, music, and myths are the other side. We tend to believe that the real truth of the invisible world is mathematical and might be put into a single unified field equation, or that it is a musical harmony of the spheres, or that it consists in mythical beings and powers with names and shapes who pull the strings that determine the visible. The three modes transpose the mystery of the invisible into visible procedures we can work with: higher math, musical notation, mythical images. Now I'll take a break from the reading so that I can locate Hillman on the philosophical map. I'm sure some of you have heard of the Carl Jung school of writing. I have some slides later on that has some of the other authors besides Hillman. When he talks about the daimon, Hillman quotes a myth from Plato's Republic. And Plato's philosophy is today considered to be a work of idealism. The notion that somewhere beyond our reality, there is a timeless realm that is more real than this one. Materialism, on the other hand, says, if I cannot see it or infer it from measurement, it's woo-woo. Rationalism says we use our minds to create order in the world. And I just put some examples of what I consider to be people who represent those different isms. It's not really a philosophy lecture, but it's kind of hard not to talk about it a little bit. These are only comic book definitions, but they give you the general idea. Back to Hillman. The invisible shows no facts. The stories that myths tell cannot be documented in history. The gods and goddesses, the heroes, their enemies, are told about in stories inscribed in clay, carved in statues. But have they ever been physically seen? The fabulous places of myth are not in this world, all invented, just fables. The long-lasting and ever-renewing vitality of myths has nothing factual behind it. Nothing but invisibles lies behind all of myth's strength. The Plato scholar Paul Friedlander says, "Myth is a mixture of truth and poetic fancy. This fading into uncertainty belongs to the very nature of myth. Usual life, too, is backed by invisibles. Those abstractions of high-energy physics such as quarks and bosons." I almost wrote bisons. Quarks and bosons that compose all the visible, palpable, and durable stuff we bump into, the invisibles of theology we kneel to, the invisible ideals that take us to war and death, the invisible diagnostic concepts that explain our marriages, our motives, our madhouses. And what about time? Has anybody seen time recently? All these invisibles, which we take so much for granted, seem so much harder and firmer than the flimsy fantasies of myth. We live among a throng of invisibles that order us about. Family values, self-development, human relationships, personal happiness, and then another, more fierce set of mythical figures called control, success, cost-effectiveness, and the biggest and most pervasively invisible, the economy. If we were in old Florence or ancient Rome or Athens, our invisible dominance would have statues and altars, or at least painted images, as did the Florentine, Roman, and Athenian invisibles called fortune, hope, friendship, grace, modesty, persuasion, fame, ugliness, forgetfulness. Perhaps these other sorts of daily invisibles that we accept without thinking, that is, things like cost-effectiveness and so forth, perhaps they receive their hardness from our attachment to them. If we cling like barnacles to our favorite set of invisibles, then they must serve as rocks and feel as solid. Philosopher Henri Bergson explained why we prefer particles to myths. He says, "The human intellect feels at home among inanimate objects, more especially among solids, where our action finds its fulcrum and our industry its tools. Our concepts have been formed on the model of solids. Our logic is preeminently a logic of solids." William Wordsworth saw through the logic of solids, perceiving the invisible within them. And here is a quote from a Wordsworth poem. "To every natural form, rock, fruit, or flower, even the little stones that cover the highway, I gave a moral life. I saw them feel, or linked them to some feeling. The great mass lay bedded in some quickening soul, and all that I beheld respired with inward meaning." Authentic tidings of invisible things, adds William James in his essay entitled On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings. William James ironically both praises and blames this certain blindness. On the one hand, he condemns our usual perception, which cannot see the invisible inwardness of rock, fruit, and flower. On the other hand, precisely this blinding of the usual intellectual mind and the blunting of its sharp edges permits us to say, with Wordsworth, "I saw them feel." The Wordsworth passage is a statement of mythical thinking, not merely a feeling. "I saw them feel" shows a softer sensibility in intellect itself that can receive and understand the authentic tidings of invisible things. Just this sensibility and intellect which I am also calling mythic sensibility, allows you to notice the quickening soul in which our lives are bedded. The acorn is not embedded in me, like a pacemaker in my heart, but rather I am embedded in a mythical reality. Hillman finds that the therapeutic concepts of the last 100 years have shortchanged our belief in the importance of our uniqueness. He doesn't reject academic or clinical psychology, but he emphasizes that they are necessarily limited. We make the mistake of putting ourselves also within those limits. Take the famous Myers-Briggs type indicator, which is quite popular at UU Leadership School. It implies that we all fit some combination of preferences, like introvert, extrovert, feeling, thinking, and so forth. I remember a time when I used to give these letters more power than anything else in my self-understanding. But Hillman writes, "To uncover the innate image, we must set aside the psychological frames that are usually used, and mostly used up. They do not reveal enough. They trim a life to fit the frame. Developmental growth, step by step, from infancy through troubled youth to midlife and aging to death. Plodding your way through an already planned map. You are on an itinerary that tells you where you have been before you get there. Or like an averaged statistic foretold by an actuary in an insurance company. The course of your life has been described in the future perfect tense. I believe," and again, this is Hillman, me too though, "I believe we have been robbed of our true biography, that destiny written into the acorn. And we go to therapy to recover it. That innate image can't be found, however, until we have a psychological theory that grants primary psychological reality to the call of fate. Grants primary psychological reality to the call of fate. Otherwise, your identity continues to be that of a sociological consumer determined by random statistics. Repression, the key to personality structure in all therapy schools, is not of the past, but of the acorn and the past mistakes we have made in our relation with it. We dull our lives by the way we conceive them. We dull our lives by the way we conceive them. We have stopped imagining them with any sort of romance, any fictional flair. So this book also picks up the romantic theme, daring to envision biography in terms of very large ideas such as beauty, mystery, and myth. How can we use these words to reimagine our life stories? Let's continue the notion of bridges between the visible and the invisible. In earlier times, right up through the Middle Ages, there were various kinds of bridges with the invisible. If you've done anthropology or you've watched enough nature or whatever, Nova on TV, you know that there used to be a lot of so-called connections between us and this other whatever it is. But with the Reformation and the Enlightenment, many of these so-called bridges were reconsidered to be dumb superstitions or just plain evil. Here's Hillman again. "The retraction of our interest from what rational consciousness calls magical, mystical, mythological, merges all the imaginal bodies indiscriminately into the monstrous. Result, the invisible becomes alien. The alienation of the invisible makes it more eerie and distant, and more represented by werewolves, time warps, and abductions in the Stephen Kingdom of our culture. Our modern passages are so narrow and with such low ceilings, the invisibles must twist themselves into freakish shapes in order to come through. Maybe what comes from elsewhere will make me do crazy things. Maybe that invisible world is demonic and should be excluded. What I can't see, I can't know. What I don't know, I fear. What I fear, I hate. What I hate, I want destroyed. So the rationalized mind prefers the chasm to the bridge. It likes the cut that separates the realms. Oop, try again. From inside its concrete debunker, all invisibles appear the same and bad. There are yet further questions regarding the relations between visible and invisible. In the kingdom of the West, or should we call it the Mall of the West, consciousness has lifted the transcendent ever higher and farther away from actual life. The bridgeable chasm has become a cosmic void. The gods have withdrawn, said the poet Hölderlin and Rilke. It takes a leap of faith, said Soren Kierkegaard. Not even that will do, for God is dead, said Nietzsche. Any bridge must be of superhuman proportions. Well, that kind of bridge our culture has ready to hand. The greatest bridge, some say, ever constructed between visible and invisible. The figure of Jesus Christ. But the bishops argued about whether Jesus was really just an exceptional man adopted by God, or whether he was God all along but wearing human skin. Some glue, some independent link was required to hold these two theological incommensurables together. A third term that was different from the other two and that could join mortal and immortal. This third person, Christian theology named the Holy Ghost. But this figure, too, belongs among the invisibles, which still tilts the balance away from the world. To summarize, the diamond's nature, or the calling's nature, and the soul's code cannot be encompassed by physical means. Only curious thought, devotional feeling, suggestive intuition, and daring imagination. This theory, this acorn theory, is meant to inspire and revolutionize, and also to excite a fresh, erotic attachment to its subject, your subjective and personal autobiography, the way you imagine your life. Because how you imagine your life strongly impinges upon the raising of children, the attitudes toward the symptoms and disturbances of adolescence, your individuality in a democracy, the strangeness of old age, and the duties of dying. This talk will probably be remembered as the day that Brewer went over the edge to woo-woo. But if I have understood Hillman, there is but a short step from woo-woo to woo-hoo! I'm going to end here and run a little slideshow that shows where these writers like Hillman have shown up in the tradition that began back in 1875 with Carl Jung. I don't know if you can read the tiny font at the bottom. Toni Wolff was one of Carl Jung's subjects, and she later became a writer. Some of these other names I did not recognize when I went to Google to find them. I'm sure everybody's heard of Joseph Campbell. Then the little arrows you see up above show what their lifespans were, where they fit in the chronology. Some of them are still alive and well. Hillman only died a few years ago. Robert A. Johnson's one of my favorites. He wrote these real short books called He and She, which are based on myths. and there's Hillman, where he fits in. Robert Bly, I think everybody remembers from all of his talks. And then Sanford, I believe, is still living. I've heard him talk. There's a group over in Kansas City called the Friends of Jung, and for a while they were bringing all these celebrities in to speak for weekend workshops. Jean Shinoda Bolen wrote a book called The Goddesses in Every Woman, and it was basically a feminist book, but it was so popular that she ended up writing a companion book called Gods in Every Man. And then Thomas More, you may remember, wrote books called Care of the Soul and other books that had the word soul in them. So you really get immersed in this kind of vocabulary. And I think because this was such a popular topic back in the 80s, it basically wore out its welcome and people started saying, what have you done for me lately? And so you don't hear too much about this anymore. Anyway, that's my talk for this morning, and I'll stick around if you have any questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to author and analyst John Brewer on tonight's forum when he spoke at the Unitarian Fellowship of Lawrence back on January 11th. We'll be back for a Q&A session after these short messages here on 90.1 FM KKFI. Once again, here's the Q&A session with John Brewer here on today's forum.
It seems to me that almost all of this grows out of the idea of transcendentalism, a good Unitarian preoccupation.
He quotes Emerson two or three times. Emerson changed a lot, and I'm not an Emerson specialist, but he's the sort of person you can cherry pick to get to hear about whatever you want to. I think Jung came after all of that stuff, so it would be interesting to try to draw a map between those two worlds.
When you or Hillman say visible or invisible, when visible, does that include all that can be apprehended through the senses, like hearing? And those senses really are experienced in the brain. And so are feelings, which seem not to be visible, but they're also manifested if you look at brain imaging that people do now. So it seems the boundaries are getting really blurry.
Weekend Edition ran an interview with a guy who was talking about flavors and taste this morning. Some of you may have heard it. And he says, taste is what happens with your tongue, but flavor is a combination of your nose and your tongue and your brain all working together, and we end up reading these things together. But certainly, he meant anything that is sensible that you can touch or hear or infer. I mean, this cosmology stuff, you can't see any of that. It took a terrific amount of math and hope and courage for people to figure out that the universe had this history. That would all be considered to be okay by a materialist thinker because we feel that we can show our steps, like in a geometric proof. Hey, Tom.
I've got two of them. One is, when and where are you going to publish this? I want a copy of both the voice track and the video. And the other is, would you like to expand on what you brought up last night, vocation or character as destiny?
Well, certainly you should just read Hillman's writing. I mean, one thing that I realized I had to do, his sentences go on for a while, and they're quite easy to digest if you're just reading them. But if you read them to somebody out loud, you just get lost. And so I had to do a lot of cutting. But he's written about, 25 or 30 books. And I'm sure his thinking has changed over that long period. I'd be happy to share my PowerPoint and my script with you. And what we were talking about last night at the men's group, and by the way, that's one of the joys I should have shared. We had about 8 or 9 guys out here eating a lot of meat and drinking beer. We talked about this, we talked about medication, we talked about what it is that helps people stay functional. It's really an interesting discussion. And I realized right away, because both Tom and Daniel gave me some flack about this. They said, it's a nice thought. And then they started giving me some of the other philosophical roots about this. And I thought, well, I hope they'll be quiet when they come to church this morning. Paul, did you want to ask or say something?
Well, myths go both ways. I mean, a lot of the Greek myths turned out to have a basis in fact. And, of course, people are exploring Christian myths, and some of them turn out to be pure fancy and so forth. And I think this is a related thought that supernatural things, I mean, I would say, okay, there is no supernatural. We call things we don't understand supernatural, but as soon as we can explain them and understand them, then they become natural. And so maybe, you know, the psychologist will eventually get to this thing called soul or whatever, and then we'll all agree, it's real. It's not woo-woo anymore.
Well, take something like remote viewing. This is something that most people would consider to be totally bogus and woo-woo, the idea that I can see something that's going on in another country. And yet the Army has spent big bucks on this, and they have figured out that some people can really do it. I mean, I have a whole list of these things. I mean, all the stuff my wife does with body work, chakras and meridians, all that stuff, homeopathics, to me, that's all in the woo-woo stuff. You know, where do you draw the bridge? But, I mean, if we think we've seen the last bridge today, you know, we've got some new surprises coming. I bet this remote viewing thing is actually true. I just don't know how. You have to figure out some kind of a theoretical mechanism so you can connect it to all of your other your structures of knowing. Are we done? Oh, a couple more. Thank you, Alan. Well, Carol's got the mic right now. Go ahead and let her.
Well, I hope I understood what you said, and I'm not misinterpreting. But it did seem to me that Hillman said that character and your fate are sort of encapsulated in you from the beginning, and you try to measure up to it, or you should try to measure up to it somehow. Doesn't that seem like predestination in a way?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, his word is not up, it's down. The Jungians feel that our challenge is to get our feet in the earth and not worry about going to heaven. And so this is a huge difference between them and Christian philosophers who are saying, you know, like his chapter on mediocrity includes Oliver North and Tom Dewey and Billy Graham. And that was the first chapter I read because I thought, you know, well, Billy Graham. But he really salutes these people for what they were so good at. And he says, this really represents some aspects of American character at its best. But he says, no, your soul is imaged. That is, there's a little imprint. This is in the Platonic myth of Ur, out there somewhere. But it's your homework assignment to bring that down to the natural world and to manifest it in the flesh and blood. That's not much of an answer, but that's the best one I can give you. Okay.
Hi. I was thinking about what role church organizations like the Unitarians play in this process of bridges, where and especially your image of that the bridge, one of the biggest bridges of modern times is Christianity, and yet it has obviously been abused and used politically in a lot of ways over many hundreds of years. But trying to create bridges that are much more humanitarian or, to my mind, much more ethical seems like a huge challenge to things like the Unitarian Church or, you know, other organizations. I was just wondering, does that make sense to you? If you could.
Well, Hillman is no ethical Boy Scout. He does not believe we are put here to obey a bunch of good conduct rules. He is more of a polytheist. You know, he really thinks that we're pulled in 20 different directions by different forces, and it's not just a monotheistic reality out there. He feels that that squeezes too much and that puts so much onto the whole Jesus thing that Jesus becomes an impossible promise to deliver. He has to do everything and more.
Several years ago, I was in an agitated state, and my grandmother came and talked to me. Susan Harper has, in an earlier talk, described a similar affair. And yesterday at the women's group, something similar came up, in which people agreed that sometimes dying people waited until the family came in order to die. And this was said by a couple of people, and it certainly was said by my family when my husband died, that he did not die till I got there. And this, despite, you know, all the irrationality of that, it seems to me that many people have had these experiences, which, and the fact that they're invisible does not invalidate their reality.
Yeah, you hear the same thing said about people waiting until Christmas or till New Year's. They hang on for a few extra weeks or months. I don't have any data or ideas on that, but it seems like that might be true.
Just parenthetically to add to that, in my life I've known a couple of people who knew things that were happening halfway around the world. It was hard to dispute that in any kind of way, shape, or form. I mean, it was clear that they did. And in relation to dying and different things that happen, there's a book, I think this is called Final Gifts, that's done by a couple of hospice nurses who've documented an awful lot of things that have happened along the way.
Yeah, I've got a book like that that says sometimes people wait until just their last few days before they're able to enter this chapter of magnanimity or whatever it is. And I haven't been around too many dying people, but I think this may have been the case somewhat with my sister last August, from what I've heard from her daughters. And this thing about remote viewing, I mean, anytime you hear anything that's that weird, you think, well, what if that's really true? What does that do to my worldview? And it's scary. I can see why people want to reject this, because if they can't handle it, they don't want to be threatened by it. Let's call that a wrap.
Just a second, John.
Excuse me, go ahead.
I think that we are being foolish if we think we know all that we are capable of, that our brains know, that we understand every dimension of our and capabilities. There are people that are employed by police departments to help. They're psychic. They can know things. They can see things. There are intuitions. I mean, how many of you have had a feeling like, I shouldn't do this? And it turns out you should not have done that. You know? And sometimes, you know, people say, I've had people tell me that something told me not to get on that airplane, or not to take that trip, or that you should do something. I think there's facets to our lives that we haven't the foggiest idea what they are, and that it may those are the invisibles.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. He has a whole section on intuition that I cut out of my talk because it made it too long. But he sees intuition as something that comes from outside and just hits you. You don't work your way up to it gradually. It's just there. But that doesn't mean it's always right. It can be wrong. And that's why he says we have these other functions. We've got thinking and feeling and so forth that we can use to vet these intuitions. And we need the intuitions, but we can't just follow them blindly.
It seems to me that one of the pieces of your talk is that things we once thought were impossible have become possible. We didn't believe in atoms for a while, and now we're inclined to say we understand them, and that may be the progression of life and understanding.
Boltzmann was so discouraged because he was being rejected, he ultimately committed suicide. Some people think it's just because he couldn't get the atomic theory to be accepted, although he had other problems. But if any of you watch Jacob Bronowski's show called The Ascent of Man, you can pick up a lot of this material. It's a great show.
Hi, it's a very interesting talk. I just want to point out that there is a distinction between those things we know and can control and those things we know but cannot control. It's a big topic. You mentioned Boltzmann. There are lots of examples in science, like plate tectonics. The scientist who brought that up was made fun of as well, and yet
Alfred Wegener.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm starting to lose my point. I did. I absolutely lost my point. So I guess we're going to have to do without it. But thank you.
It's amazing how they figured out the plate tectonics. They had to use paleomagnetism to read the bottom of the oceans. Did you get your idea back? Okay, she wants to talk one more time.
It's that we can only see what we are prepared to see. That's the point. There are conceptualizations that make absolutely no sense. Honeybees can pick up magnetism. We can't. There's an invisible for you.
That's a good one. Thank you.
You've been listening to author and analyst John Brewer on today's forum. He spoke back on January 11th at the Unitarian Fellowship of Lawrence and was speaking about many things that range from the very serious to the very woo-woo. That will conclude the forum for today. We now return to some more great programming here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.